This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Michael Daventry, I'm the foreign editor of the Jewish News, and wait, I hear you ask, where are the dulcet tones of Phil Dave? The usual host of your Jewish News Podcast is alive and well, and, well, I've got to say, he's still putting this podcast together. But in a busy week for Israeli politics this week, it'll be me who takes you through the guests, both in Israel and in the UK, that I've been speaking to in the hope of trying to understand what the future has in store after Israel's fourth election in less than 2 years. Here's what's coming up. I'll be reflecting with our Jerusalem contributor Nathan Jeffy on a busy election night and the likelihood that we may see Israeli Arab ministers in the next government. Richard Pater from the think tank BICOM talks to us about what the election means for Britain's relationship with Israel. And we hear from the former Foreign Secretary Sir Malcolm Rifkind on Israel's relationship with Arab states and what he thought when he first met Benjamin Netanyahu in the 1990s. But before that, a reminder that your weekly edition of the Jewish News newspaper is out now, and not only does it have bumper coverage of the Israeli election, it also comes with the excellent glossy magazine Life, which will be a very timely read ahead of Passover. So let's begin with Nathan Jeffy, our contributor in Jerusalem. Hi Nathan, I hope you've recovered from the rather long night we've had as the results rolled in late on Tuesday night and into Wednesday morning. We're now recording this on Thursday. What do you think it looks like in terms of the next government for Israel right now?
Well, we seem to be back, Michael, in a state of stalemate because we really don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how things are going to unfold. So there's really a lot of confusion and these various directions it could take. I would stress, however, that this scenario of Benjamin Netanyahu being out of the race, not having a chance, which many people thought was inevitable given all of his troubles, that has not happened. He's still in with a chance, and really there's a reasonable chance that he could build a government, a reasonable chance that the other side could build a government, and a reasonable chance that we could go to more elections.
How would you rate the opposition's chances in this scenario? Because the opposition in particular are much more disparate than the Netanyahu camp, shall we say. I mean, they've got people like Yisrael Beiteinu and Avigdor Lieberman on the one side and the Arab parties on the other, who wouldn't countenance sitting in the same government together. Surely the opposition have a much harder job of getting to that magic 61 number than the Netanyahu camp does.
He would certainly like to think that he is. And it's really interesting because he has a lot of those kind of BB-esque characteristics. Perfect English. He's from American family. His parents are American immigrants to Israel. He has that high-tech background, so that business kind of background that BB always talks about so much. Ideologically, he's pretty close to Benjamin Netanyahu, I would say. But also quite adaptable in terms of ideology. I think there's a range of ideology that Bennett could fit into. And he used to work for Benjamin Netanyahu as his chief of staff. And really, really, it's quite conceivable that he could have stayed in Likud and made his way up Likud party, really kind of been a senior ally of Benjamin Netanyahu. But what we know about Netanyahu is he does not like people who climb up the system. There was personality clashes there. And so he ended up being in a completely different type of party. He is kind of the kingmaker. He has a huge amount of influence now. And he probably will somehow, and we're not sure exactly how, but somehow make use of that to catapult up his political career. And I think he would like to find himself kind of gunning for that prime minister's position 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, maybe even 10 years in the future. But I think he's got his eye on that prize.
Talking of kingmakers, though, another kingmaker potentially has emerged in the last 24 to 48 hours. This is Ram, the United Arab List, a conservative faction that broke away from the wider joint list of Arab parties that have run in recent Israeli elections. There's talk of Mansour Abbas, who leads this faction, possibly supporting Benjamin Netanyahu in government, which would be the first time that we have Israeli Arabs supporting an Israeli government. What do we know about him and his faction?
It is a bizarre scenario. Benjamin Netanyahu has gone out campaigning among the Arab public this time around, which is something that he's not really done much in the past. And really, ideologically, he would not like to have a non-Zionist or even an anti-Zionist faction in his coalition or supporting his coalition, but he is desperate and I think would do what it takes. He would potentially find a way of justifying it. However, on the other hand, this may all be really theoretical, because the chance that he could get both this Islamist party and the right-wing religious Zionists as well to sit together is quite far-fetched. So theoretically, yeah, this Abbas has become a kind of kingmaker, although it's difficult to conceive that Benjamin Netanyahu will be able to slot all the pieces in as necessary to actually take advantage of that.
There's lots of talk about Rahm being conservative, and others say that it's Islamist. In your view, having followed Israeli politics and living in Israel as long as you are, where would you put them on the spectrum? Because from a British point of view, conservative and Islamist mean quite different things.
Well, I think what people are trying to say is that it espouses conservative Islamic values. So in terms of what it would consider family values, in terms of its stance on GLBTQ issues, both Islamist and what would be seen here as socially conservative. So I think that's what people are saying, although the ideology does not fit into kind of Western conceptions of ideology, which is why it's difficult to plot it on a right-wing, left-wing spectrum.
Well, there's clearly going to be a fascinating couple of days of reflection in Israel over Passover before the political wrangling begins afresh next week. Okay, Nathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for your time and for your stellar work this week. This is the Jewish News podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm joined now by Richard Pater, the chief executive of BICOM, the UK-Israel think tank. He's written for this week's edition of the Jewish News. You can see it if you thumb through your copy right now. Richard, thanks very much for your time joining us in the podcast as well. I guess I wanted to pick up on the themes that you draw upon in your column. It seems at the moment the electoral mathematics are that, even though it's extremely hard, Benjamin Netanyahu is slightly closer than the opposition bloc in forming the next government. But if the Prime Minister does change, will there be much of an effect, do you think, on UK-Israel relations?
So I'll take the two questions separately, because although we're in dangerous territory, we've got 95%+ of the vote counted, we still don't know exactly the way that the blocks will balance out. And the way that it appears, I mean, it's complicated, and we can get into that if you want. But it's not clear that Netanyahu necessarily has the advantage right now. But as I said, we can get into that. In terms of how this will affect the UK, I don't think this will have a dramatic effect on UK relations. And as I outlined in the column, I think Britain-Israel relations are on a pretty strong and robust course of relations right now, and we're on safe ground. If someone else was to become prime minister, not Netanyahu, then the lead candidate appears to be Yair Lapid from the Yesh Atid party. I know from when he'd served previously as the finance minister back 7 years ago, and also head of the opposition, he'd cultivated some good, strong personal relations with several prominent Israeli politicians, by the way, including Prime Minister Boris Johnson while he was mayor of London. So they definitely have personal connections. And as kind of the nature of these things in world geopolitics, personal relations clearly matter at the highest level diplomacy these days. But more than that, I think the kind of the essence of the relationship between Britain and Israel is deep and substantial through a whole range of sectors, which will only grow and thrive, please God, in the years ahead.
So let's talk about one of those aspects of the relationship that's thriving, the military relationship. There's a huge amount going on there, from joint exercises to treaties, a lot of which are secret. Can you tell us a little bit more, for those who don't know, about what kind of military things are going on at the moment between the two countries?
So I can say a little bit, and that's partly because I know a little bit, and a lot of it is kind of under secret, and for good reason, kind of kept only amongst the senior defence officials that are handling it. But I think, broadly speaking, the UK and Israel share a similar analysis of the future of warfare, and they talk about the six dimensions and kind of having to bring in, as well as the conventional approach to military engagement, also talking about the cybersphere, which is incredibly important, and the way that you can use artificial intelligence to manage some of these systems. In a very practical sense, we saw just last week the head of the RAF visiting his counterpart in Israel. And there's a lot of, as you mentioned, kind of shared maneuvers going on with other countries as well, within kind of interoperability of air force and ground forces and these kind of relations. We also saw a big deal at the end of last year where one of the leading Israeli military companies is providing a training platform for the British Navy as well for them to operate. So I think a lot of this is kind of on the cutting edge, advanced technologies, the synthesis between cyber and how you can make technology work to get a smarter army kind of practicing and engaging in a most coherent and efficient manner.
And you talk about technology. I mean, technology isn't just exclusively military. There are civilian examples. Israel is a major hub for technological development, as we know. And we had a story in the Jewish News this week about a deal for PillCam, which is one of those colonoscopy replacements where you swallow a pill and it takes pictures of your insides as the pill goes all the way through. And the NHS had signed a deal to take that on. I imagine, I mean, you at BICOM must be studying and be aware of dozens of examples of civilian technological cooperation as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think across a whole range. I mean, you mentioned kind of the medical field as well as, and I mentioned in the article as well, the digitalization of the NHS, kind of learning from the way the Israeli system works in kind of the relationship between health providers and the patients, and kind of getting all of that information and interchange online and through apps is kind of a well-worn process in Israel that I think the UK wants to pick up on. Another huge sector is fintech, and there's Israeli technologies working with a whole range of high street banks and other financial institutions within the UK to keep them safe and unhackable, and also providing a convenient and efficient user face for customers as well. Agritech, other kind of advancements within the biotech sphere as well. Yeah, I mean there are plenty of fields where there is strong collaboration.
And last question, just a slightly more broader one. Netanyahu was particularly made a lot during this election campaign about his role in the Abraham Accords and the fact that Israel is now having more diplomatic relations explicitly with more Arab countries than before. Surely from a British point of view, in a post-Brexit world where Britain is looking to partners beyond the EU, not just for trade, but for all sorts of relations, an Israel that is more actively engaged with its immediate neighbours is only valuable to Britain.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there is a lot more in this space as we just understanding the realms of possibilities that the Abraham Accords allows Israel in kind of engagement. A lot of those similar issues, by the way, that we just discussed between Britain and Israel also apply for Israel sharing similar technology and partnerships with the future of the Arab world. I think there's also an incredible opportunity because of the UK's traditional close relations with countries like Saudi Arabia as well, that the UK could also provide a bridge to bring those countries closer together. You may be aware that Israel has at the moment quite difficult relations with the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And again, the UK's historical role playing there could provide useful space to help the rapprochement there between the sides. And more broadly, kind of as Israel looks to engage with the wider Arab world, there is only kind of the UK relationship can only complement that.
Fascinating stuff. We'll be watching it further as the weeks unfold in this election and as the years unfold in this UK-Israeli relationship. Richard Pater from BICOM, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, the Conservative MP Sir Malcolm Rifkind was Foreign Secretary in the final years of John Major's government from 1995 to 1997. It was a period that also saw the first election victory in Israel for one Benjamin Netanyahu. When I spoke to Sir Malcolm earlier in the week, we discussed his thoughts about one of Israel's most successful and most divisive politicians, yes, but I began by asking him if Israel's foreign policy would change, if its prime minister changed too.
Well, I think the question of a change in foreign policy and any change in relation to the Palestinians, as if anything, become less likely in a negative sense because of the establishment of diplomatic relations with the UAE and with the other countries. And if you remember, Netanyahu at one stage was proposing to annex the Jordan Valley, and part of the arrangement that led to diplomatic relations with the UAE and other countries, was that that idea was going to be dropped. And so the difference in foreign policy may not be as acute for that particular reason as it would have been if the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, etc. had not now become very meaningful countries with a relationship with Israel.
I suppose what I'm curious about is, you're quite right to point out that there's been quite a change since from talk of annexing the Jordan Valley to all of a sudden forming diplomatic relations with all of these countries that Israel never had relations with before. But I'm wondering how much of this is dependent on Netanyahu himself, seeing as he was the one throughout the campaign promising that Oman might be following, there may be Qatar, possibly even Saudi Arabia, forming some form of diplomatic connection explicitly with Israel. I'm wondering how much you feel it's based on Netanyahu himself that this process would continue.
Well, I think although Netanyahu is entitled to claim a significant amount of the credit for that breakthrough having been achieved, I don't think his future depends on Netanyahu. The reasons why these countries have decided to recognize Israel has got nothing to do with the personality of the current Israeli prime minister. It is because of the way in which Middle Eastern politics as a whole has changed fundamentally because of the anxiety of Arab states as to the policy of Iran. And when you have Israel and Arab countries sharing the same views as to the nature of the Iranian threat, then it is not necessarily that surprising, although at one level it is still astonishing how far it's gone, that you have close strategic alliance. Now, we've known for years, even before recognition, that Israel in reality did have quite substantial private contacts with Saudi Arabia, with UAE, with a number of other Arab countries. Of course, that's now come out into the public domain. What will have been noticed, and including in Saudi Arabia, is how little hostile reaction there has been to that from, as it were, the general public in Arab countries. It was always said that if Arab states contemplated normalization relations with Israel, the Arab street, as it was called, would rise in protest and make it extremely difficult, which probably would have been true 5, 10 or 20 years ago. It's manifestly not true now. The Palestinian issue has not been resolved, not remotely resolved. It's still a big issue. But it doesn't give rise to the same emotion and instinctive public practical support from Arab states, or it would appear from Arab public opinion, than it would have been the case not all that long ago. And that's not because of Netanyahu. That is a sea change which has happened, because the old saying is true, my enemy's enemy is sometimes my friend. You know, I mean, there was a similar, much more, even more important development during the Second World War, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. Stalin became an ally and an accepted ally of Roosevelt and Churchill, not because they had any illusions about Stalin, but because there was an overriding imperative which all three countries shared. Now, in that sense, I don't want to take the comparison too far, but in that sense, there is some parallel here. It's not that the Arab states have suddenly decided they love Israel, or Israel loves the Arab states. I don't think that's the case, but they do have a deep strategic interest. One final point. Of course, they're also conscious that the United States, not just under Trump, but inevitably under Biden, will be treating the Middle East as less of a priority than in the past. Now, that is partly because America has been bitten so much by its experience in Iraq and other parts of the Middle East, but it also reflects the lower importance in an economic point of view because of the declining significance of oil. The Arab states have less diplomatic clout, and with the Americans' own development of their domestic shale supplies of oil, America is now self-sufficient. So that doesn't mean the United States is going to withdraw from the Middle East. It still has very substantial strategic interests, both because of its relationship with Israel, its friendship with Israel, which isn't going to change, but also because the last thing it wants to see is Russia becoming the leading external power in the region, which obviously, given what's happened in Syria, is a potential risk. And they also know that China's very active. So America's not going to withdraw, but America is no longer required simply to, as it were, think of Saudi Arabia or other Arab states as the absolutely essential allies in the way that was true during the Cold War and in more recent years.
Allow me then, just I realise that we're a little short on time, so allow me to squeeze in one last question. Back on Netanyahu himself, when you were Foreign Secretary, Netanyahu began his first term, it was while you were serving as Foreign Secretary, and so you would have had dealings with him. Yes. I wonder, given, I'm not asking you to comment on the machinations of Israeli politics, but there is a little bit of a rumour out there at the moment, given there is an Israeli presidential election this summer, that one of the ways that the Netanyahu problem could be resolved is by elevating him to the presidency and sort of giving him the elder statesman role that he has been so craving. So I just wonder if you would be interested in thinking back briefly to the mid-90s and what you actually thought of this man who was in his 40s, but pretended he was in his 60s. What kind of an impression did he make upon you?
Well first, before I will respond to that, but before I do, I mean, the presidency of Israel is essentially a ceremonial symbolic post, and I'm not certain that Netanyahu has yet considers that he's reached the sort of retirement phase where this would be the sort of final stage of his political career. Now, that may happen, and it might be, if he realised he couldn't continue as prime minister, he might accept that as a consolation prize. But I think it's the last thing he has in mind as his top priority. And remember also, there's still the corruption charges hanging over him, which make it quite difficult to contemplate anyone agreeing to him being the head of state. There's already been one previous Israeli president who ended up spending some time behind bars. So I think that's a very good
Indeed.
Precedent. I do know Netanyahu. I haven't seen him recently, but I've met him a number of times, not just when he was prime minister, but also when he was in opposition. I remember once by accident bumping into him in the King David Hotel. We had a sort of long chat then. He's an extremely astute political animal, and he's an entirely astute political animal. There is a high degree of tactical skill to be able to have survived in the maelstrom of Israeli politics for so long, and with the corruption charges hanging over him, and without the ability to deliver for his own Likud party a majority and therefore dependent on others, shows that he is a maestro compared to almost anyone in Israeli politics. Whether that's been healthy for Israel is another matter. I don't personally agree with much of what Netanyahu has done with regard to the Palestinian issue. I don't have an instinctive solidarity with him on that. But as a being myself a political animal, I admire a true professional when I see one. And you know, by any standards, he has been a remarkable figure and continues to be as we speak. And may, depending on what happens with the criminal allegations, he may very well be around for at least another 4 or 5 years. I don't see him aspiring to the presidency. But, you know, Shimon Peres eventually accepted it. But only when he realized the real opportunities of political power were no longer available to him.
The former Foreign Secretary, Sir Malcolm Rifkin, who was speaking to me earlier in the week. And that's it for this edition in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit gpg.org. All I have to do is to thank my guests, Nathan Jeffy, Richard Pater, and Sir Malcolm Rifkind. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way, you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on anything to do with the Israeli election, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. From me, Michael Daventry, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast, and goodbye.